Hey guys, on this episode of Muscle Minds, Dr. Scott and I do a Q&A style episode. We start out talking about the metabolic stress of a set, meaning what you're getting out of the concentric portion of a rep, the eccentric portion. We talk about failure, which is one of our favorite topics, what you get out of partials compared to regular reps. From there, we go into talking about isometric contractions. How beneficial are they? Could you grow some muscle with them? We talk about a bunch more. Scott goes down a ton of rabbit holes as usual. We're going to do that all right here, right now on Muscle Minds. Today, guys, we have a Q&A. We're going to do a Q&A episode for you here. Dr. Scott put out a call for some questions over at his Instagram page, and he has forwarded me on everything that we've got here. Let me see if I can pull this up and see where we want to get started. We got quite a few. You got a pretty good pretty good feedback here. Let's see. Is there anything you wanted to specifically start with? That
Yeah, okay. There is actually. It was from Alfredo Tessitore. I just have to pretend like I'm ordering something in an Italian restaurant, and yeah. I'm sure it sounds exactly like perfectly.
It was good. I thought it was good.
Tessitore, you know, pizza tessitore, linguine, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so he says, and this is related to what we're talking about, Are, and I'm not sure exactly what he means by this, but are density and frequency the keys of these quarantine home workouts? Thank you, Professor. So I think by density, tell me if this is your best guess too, Scotty. He means volume per unit time. So like sort of the metabolic stress maybe in a set, or just doing lots of sets with short rest intervals. I'm thinking more so the latter.
That's, yeah, I think I would agree with
frequency.
You.
So it's funny. I would say, well, here's the thing. The keys, if we're talking about keys for hypertrophy, they don't change. What changes is the lock that you're using to try to open up the hypertrophic stimulus. But the way you do that is with the same types of things that you would be using anyway, the same program variables of volume,
yeah,
a higher frequency regime. And it, in my mind, it's always been a function of effort, or quote unquote, you know, psychological intensity of effort. And I happen to have found something that I thought was pretty cool, and I was thinking we could talk about it, and it just so happened that I can bring it up right now. And it's from a paper by, let's see here, Stu Phillips.
You talked about Stu before.
Oh yeah, Stu's the man. So he's sort of leading the path here on, oh gosh, looking at basically the molecular biology. He's done a lot of stuff with muscle protein synthesis, sort of the acute, and then also the long-term chronic adaptations to resistance exercise. He's done a ton of stuff, been published all over the place, looking at the impact of protein on muscle growth. So let me see if I can find this passage. So I'll read some of these things. Let me see. Maybe I can find a different spot. I don't want to spend too much time reading. So a number of meta-analyses on the impact of different resistance exercise. This is from a paper that actually was published. It's kind of hidden because the title of the paper is from 2015, Nutritional Interventions to Augment Resistance Training-Induced Skeletal Muscle Hypertrophy. The first name is Morton. And this still holds despite what's come out since then. There's been some frequency or some volume studies, which we talked about here previously. But he says, in contrast to current recommendations, we propose that an important variable to consider in regards to the optimization of muscle protein synthesis and subsequent hypertrophic responses to ensure, regardless of the load lifted, so loads are going to be potentially lower here with the bands, just because you can't, like that squat video that I had where I looked like the giant with the fee-fi-fo-fum,
yeah,
moving around. Like, it was hard to get into that. Like, it's going to be difficult to get with just using bands, these home setups, high loads. But you can do higher rep training. So they say, regardless of the load lifted, that loads are lifted to the point of contractile failure.
Mm.
They're really pushing the failure aspect here. Contractile failure, particularly when lifting lighter loads, often occurs when there is significant muscle fatigue and motor unit activation. That means you're these are friggin' brutal. They're very, very hard. Motor unit activation refers to the size and quantity of motor units, the term muscle fatigue. Let's move forward here. Significant muscle fatigue is reached by activating and exhausting a full cadre of motor units and thus fiber types, and regardless of any resistance exercise variable, requires a high degree of effort.
Yeah, okay.
From a broad prescriptive standpoint, we have emphasized the need for a high degree of effort in performing resistance exercise. We propose that manipulation of a multitude of resistance exercise variables may mean much less in terms of stimulating hypertrophy, than simply exerting a high degree of effort to achieve contractile failure. Hmm. You got to train hard.
Yeah.
And you can do that with bands. There was a video, it's on my Instagram, and it's just like a two back from where it currently is right now, of me doing a kind of a pec fly with the bands. I had a I had this bifurcation in a tree, and I was able to hook a band on either side of the tree, and it was perfect for doing a fly, and it was awesome. I just did one straight set, but it was a really good set, and it was total grinder. It just had a really nice loading curve. And someone asked me, he's like, can you get a pump from doing training with bands? And I'm like, no, I got no pump from that whatsoever. Like, see if you can find, like, scan around right now. See if you can find anyone who looks like they had a harder set than that. Like,
yeah,
like today, you're probably not going to find much harder effort than that one.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. And I mean, there's one other, let's see here. I wanted to, one other section I wanted to read from too.
And that reminds me, when I spoke to Mario Novo with the blood flow restriction show that just came out, he was talking about muscular growth, and I'm not sure where he was citing it from, but that the key was in, what did he say? He said, it's that when weights slow down, when your movement slows down, that's where the muscle actually is getting activated the most, to like where you're triggering the most growth. And I said, so you mean like a slow, you know, controlled movement? And he said, no, when your body gets to the point that it can't go faster, meaning whether you did 10 reps or whether you did 25 reps, you know, you get to that point where the weight begins to slow down, you know, and I guess what we're talking about is that, you know, you can achieve that in different rep ranges. It's not just something that, you know, you have to have, you know, just six reps to failure type weight. You know, you could get that with, you could still activate with higher reps. It just reminded me of something that, and like I said, I'm not sure where he got that from, but it's something that seemed like it kind of correlated with what you're saying here.
Yeah. Well, there's a growing body of literature looking at velocity of training as a way to program the training, because the velocity of movement that you can create when you're giving up, when you're performing maximal effort movements with isotonically, like with a free weight, is a function of the level of fatigue that you've created. And it's also a function of how many reps in reserve you have. And it also tells you when you're starting to get into the truly the effective reps. So I'm in the draw on right now, but we know about the force velocity curve. So slower a movement, if you think about an isometric contraction being no movement whatsoever, and then you try to move something at faster and faster speeds, the load that you can move at a really fast speed is much lower than what you could move at a slower speed.
Okay.
So the faster a muscle is contracting, the less force it can produce. So that kind of makes sense. I always call this the merry-go-round effect. So, like, if you're ever the kid, like, come on, Scott, push us. Everyone would get on the merry-go-round, and you're the one who had to push everyone. And when you start, when they're standing still and not moving, you could push really hard. You could produce a lot of force.
Okay.
And then as it starts to go faster and faster and faster, you feel like you're hardly adding any force whatsoever.
Yeah.
Just think about how much force is on your hands when you're pushing on one of the bars on the merry-go-round. You can feel it right there.
Yeah.
So the faster the movement, the less the amount of force, until at some point in time, that merry-go-round was going around so fast, you could literally just, you put your hands on it, you weren't adding any force at all.
Yeah, yeah.
It was basically nothing. So that would be like the maximal velocity of contraction if you looked at a singular muscle in isolation. So max force, you got an isometric force. You actually could produce more force during eccentric contractions, but we'll leave that for now. And then the force you could produce gets less and less and less. So as muscle starts, so let's think of that in reverse. We'll flip it around now. As muscle starts to fatigue, in order to produce the force to move the weight, you have to use more and more muscle.
Okay.
And that means you're going to work your way back up the force velocity curve, where it becomes very, very slow. And you see this in a set. Like, you can tell if you train someone in the gym or with a training partner, those grinder reps happen at really slow velocities.
Yeah.
You can, the first rep, you can just move the shit out of it. And you don't even want to do that so much because you're just bouncing the weight around.
Right.
You're using stretch shortening cycles and you're loading the elastic elements in the muscle, not the contractile apparatus as much. So you're basically just producing high power movements,
yeah.
But it's not from the muscle. So, but as the set ensues, the max speed at which you can move the weight becomes less and less and less.
Yeah, yeah.
So eventually you reach the point where you fail, and that's an isometric contraction using all the weight you can, and you can only hold that weight. If you were a rep or two before that, you're going very, very slow. You're using all the muscle you can, but the muscle is so fatigued that weight is almost the maximal weight you could be moving at that time, and the velocity is really, really slow.
Mm.
So velocity, it definitely, you can tell when someone is sandbagging a set.
Yeah.
You see, like, the first rep looks like the last rep.
Yeah.
There's no change in the speed of movement.
So you're telling me too. So I'm just visualizing, you know, like a curl, that as I'm curling those early reps, I'm not using as many muscle fibers in those first, say, six reps as I am in the last six. That I just find that interesting because I honestly didn't know that. You know, I've been, you know, training a long time, but I never thought that. I assumed that you're using almost less. I never thought about it, but I almost felt like maybe you're using less fibers because less of them are, like, you've already burnt them out. They're not working as much. But now what you're telling me is that every time you do another rep, your body needs to use more of those fibers in order to move the weight because they're getting fatigued. That makes so much sense, and it makes sense as to why those later reps are so important.
So people will say, and the literature on this is pretty limited because you can't make these measurements in the big muscles as easily as it can be done in smaller muscles. A lot of these measurements on motor unit activation are like done in the hand muscles, some of the muscles that move the thumb around and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if you go to like 70 or 80% of a max of a one rep maximum, and you produce force repeatedly, you may be using all of the motor units. People say there's 100% motor unit activation with a 70 or 80% one rep max load.
Okay.
But here's the thing. So we'll start off with, so that would be like maybe 8 or 10 rep set. But the thing is, you will be using all of those motor units when the weight gets higher, but you're not using them all continuously.
Yeah.
So here I've done this. I've taught this so many times in classroom and various things, but I usually have a group of people, and let's say you have three rows of people, and we'll call them the low threshold, the medium threshold, and the high threshold motor unit. So the low threshold get activated when there's just a little bit of force demands, a little bit of fatigue demands. Nothing's really all that difficult, like at the beginning of a set.
Yeah.
And then you go to the medium, and then you go to the high threshold. So you might pick, like, let's say you're going to do like a 30 rep set. So it's pretty light, kind of the easier for the sake of understanding. And you would first turn on that first row of motor units, the low threshold motor units. Those are going to be your type 1 fibers. And in order to do the first rep, let's say you've got 10 people per row, you might activate 7 of those for the first rep. And then you might, the next rep, the other three might, like, come into play, but only 2 would turn off because you got a little bit of fatigue coming in. So now you're using 8 motor units, and then you start doing more and more reps, and eventually the medium threshold motor units would come into play, But the nervous system is very smart. It doesn't just like turn them on and put all the load on the motor units that are being used. They rotate amongst themselves. So motor units will turn on and turn off. So instead of taking 8 motor units and turning them on at maximum firing rates all at once, it would use 10 motor units or 12 motor units and turn them on and off so they don't fatigue as much. And it would turn them on at firing rates that aren't quite maximal, but don't produce terribly shaky contractions, but aren't quite the maximal firing rate. So you go rep after rep, and fatigue starts to ensue. Eventually, those lower threshold motor units are pretty much all being used to some degree. Yeah. The medium threshold motor units are being turned on, but you're still rotating amongst yourselves until you get to the end of the set. Huh. And if you're someone who really can take the set to maximal motor unit activation, meaning all of them are turned on at the very end of your set at the maximum firing rate, at least the maximum rate that's needed, then you might have all of the motor units turned on. But that takes a tremendous amount of effort. And I don't think most people can do that, or most people are not willing to do that on a regular basis in the gym.
It takes, and why aren't they willing to do that?
It takes a tremendous amount of psychological effort. Like that is all out. Imagine your best effort ever. Like there is no way in effing hell I'm going to get 10 reps on a squat or whatever.
Yeah.
No matter what, it's going to happen. And the way that would see, and Mario was totally dead on with this. This is why this body of literature is starting to grow. Practical application is a little bit weird because you're not going to be able to like measure velocity of movement in the gym most of the time, but you can see that during the course of time, as you're going from the easy part of the set at the beginning and you're starting to activate more and more motor units, now the muscle's fatiguing. That actually slows the muscle down somewhat too and changes what motor unit firing rates are used.
Yeah.
But as it fatigues, eventually you get to the point where you're trying to use all the muscle you have just to keep the weight moving.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
You can't move that weight any more quickly than you are, really, and continue the set. So the speed of movement will eventually slow down lower than what your typical tempo would be.
Okay.
And at that point, you know, if you can activate all those motor units, then you'll be at whatever the max firing rate is, which will be lower than at the beginning of the set, and that's a whole other – it's a whole other topic. That the nervous system has all these strategies to prevent fatigue and also protect you as well.
Yeah.
You can't maximally activate during an eccentric contraction. Humans can't do that.
Huh.
There's a built-in, like, I've never seen any, maybe there's some that can in some situations, but the amount of force that you would produce in skeletal muscle if you could maximally activate it during a lengthening contraction would be at least 40% greater than probably more like 50-60% greater than your one rep max, 40% greater than your max effort. Yeah.
So what, would we just like tear muscle from bone at that point or what?
Probably. Yeah. There'd be tremendous muscle damage, and delayed onset muscle damage and muscle an initial injury and then damage thereafter.
Hmm.
So there's an inherent, inhibitory mechanism at play there.
Okay.
So yeah, they've done like, you can test this. We have talked about this before. You can test a motor unit activations with various techniques where they take e-stim and they superimpose an electrical stimulus on top of a voluntary max effort. And the idea is like, if you push as hard as you can and they superimpose the twitch with e-stim and there's some motor units that you weren't activating and they get activated by the e-stim, you can use that to kind of interpolate. It's called a twitch interpolation technique. You can interpolate what amount of muscle you weren't able to activate.
Huh. We have a few people that are chiming in with more questions too. There was one that actually would tie in with this.
Sure.
Paige asks, are partials at the end of an exercise till failure beneficial if your muscles are not completely exhausted?
Well, they'll add some time under tension. They'll add some metabolic stress. So if you take kind of depends on whether you've taken the set to basically where you've got zero reps in reserve and now all you can do is partials. In that case, So here's the way to think about that. We'll take a step back. People talk about these effective reps. It's a very useful conceptual idea. So you're going to do a set of 12, and let's say the last – if you only did 8 with a set of 12, you're not going to get much of a stimulus out of that. If you do 9 reps, then maybe that only that 9th rep was an effective rep, let's say.
Okay.
Some people say it's the last 5 of a set. We'll just say the last 4.
Okay.
So if you do 10 reps, you got 2 effective reps that add to the stimulus. And then if you did 12 reps and went to true failure, then those last 4 were all effective reps.
Mm.
So if you got a situation, and the thing that's also worth considering is that in terms of the stimulus you get from each of those last 4 reps, they're not all the same. The effort of rep number 9 is not anywhere near the effort of rep number 12 if you fail at 13, let's say.
Okay.
So what you get from rep 12 is much more than what you get from rep 9. And, you know, how to quantify that, I mean, you could do some studies. There's so much variability to response and adaptation. It'd be tough to do. But I think we kind of agree on that, you know, that sets to 12 with a 12 rep or with a failure on your 13th effort to get a 13th rep. So sets to 12 with a 12 rep max are definitely tougher than sets of 9 with a 12 rep max.
Yeah.
So you say you do all 12 reps, and then you're not going to get a 13th one.
Mm-hmm.
But you get up, that the velocity slows, you push, and then you can come back in, and you might be able to do another 10 seconds of partials there. Well, what you've effectively done is extended the set by, that might be like how long it would take you to do 2 or 3 reps.
Yeah.
You can't say that those partials are equivalent to having done 2 or 3 reps. Because you couldn't have done those 2 or 3 reps. So those can't be equivalent, because you could do one, you couldn't do the other.
Yeah.
But you've managed to extend the set, it's an intensification technique, and continue to produce metabolic stress. And you extended the period where you've got really, really high efforts. And for that person, literally, like you might, if like you tried that 13th rep, and it's like, okay, this is not going. You got to get out of there.
Yeah.
It's not safe. You rack it, or you drop it, or your partner brings it up for you. Maybe you do a forced rep. We'll just leave that to the side. But now you do those partials. You can literally do those partials if you're in a safe way for doing this in a machine or in a rack or what have you, where you are you're getting extended period of maximal effort and maximal motor unit activation that you wouldn't have otherwise. That's going to be pretty damn impressive. So that's like when you've gone to that 12th rep and you got no more reps left in the tank, and you add the partials to extend the set. Now, if you go to like, this is what her question, why her question was a little bit wishy-washy. And let's say you just go to 9,
mm-hmm.
and then you just do like an equivalent, you know, 6 or 8 seconds of partials.
Yeah.
What you get out of those 6 seconds, those would probably be pretty easy.
I see.
Because you could do those without a problem. In fact, all you could do after you did 12 reps were those partials. You had nothing left. That's the only thing you could do in lieu of having a partner who wants to let you do a forced rep.
Yeah.
That's all you could do to maintain and extend the set. Whereas if you do that extra 6 or 8 seconds after the 9th rep,
yeah.
Well, that's a breeze. It's not going to be that hard at all.
Yeah. It's almost like you, I think that like the scenario, it's tough. So, even like if I know that when I've done pre-exhausting, a lot of times the way I've tried to explain it to people is, okay, well, you're going to do hamstring curls first, but the way we do hamstring curls, I don't want you to think about the fact that we're going to squat after this. You know, right. Like we want you to
don't
really give
the hamstring curls.
Yeah. We want you to give everything to these hamstring curls, not trying to save something in the tank, you know? And I almost feel like I can see what you're saying, that if you knew, okay, I'm going to do partials at the end of this set, you just have to be honest with yourself. Am I still going to get as many quality reps, or am I going to cut it shy because I know I'm going to partials, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and you could, and there's also some optimization that could be had there too. It could be that like that 12th rep is like it's like an 8-second grinder rep.
Yeah.
And you want to include partials. That's just something that you've included in your program is on this set. I take it, you know, to 1 or 0 reps in reserve. And I do some partials. then maybe you cut, leave a rep shy, because you can either get one rep or maybe not get that rep, but you know you can do 10 or 15 seconds of partials.
Yeah.
And you're favoring that over that last rep. So, you know, 6-1. Here's the thing though, when you're doing partials, those are negatives.
Mm.
Essentially, those are like pulse negatives.
Yeah.
And you're stronger, they're either isometric with a little bit of concentric, but you're generally doing an eccentric contraction. So you can produce more force with those.
Yeah.
And the force that you produce per unit muscle is higher. And generally you see enhanced metabolic signaling from eccentric versus concentric or isometric contractions. And if you look at the studies that have compared shortening concentric versus eccentric, you generally see greater muscle growth when you pick eccentric over concentric. So Brad Schoenfeld has a meta-analysis he's done to that effect.
Okay.
So when you do those partials, like we're assuming that it's just kind of you're lowering there, you're able to hold on. You're doing eccentric actions, which provide a better stimulus for muscle growth. And you can prolong that as well, because the energy cost of eccentrics is substantially lower than that of concentrics.
Okay.
You can do, like in the muscle soreness studies that they do, they'll have people do 8 sets of 10 reps with their one rep max.
Okay.
Eccentric only.
Oh, okay.
Eccentric only. So you can do that. Like Per Tesh is a Scandinavian researcher, and he's got a paper that I used to present when I would teach some of this stuff, and had people do on an isokinetic dynamometer where they can literally just do the eccentrics.
Yeah.
And have people do, like, literally they lift their leg back up for them, and the machine would drive they do a knee extension, the machine would drive them into an eccentric, maximal effort, rep after rep after rep. You can do 30 reps in a row with max effort, eccentric only.
Yeah.
And with like minimal force loss. It's like 10 or 15% loss of force. Now, of course, that'll damage the shit out of you.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll whack you like a motherfucker. you can't do that with free weights.
Yeah.
Like if you have the weight here and you do a max effort, well, the weight goes back up.
Right.
You know? Or if it's so heavy that you can't hold it, you're going to have a hell of a time finding partners who are going to lift it back up for you.
Right. I don't want to work out with that guy. I don't
want to. Fuck you, man. Like, I'm done. I have to take a day off after just spotting you, you know?
Right, right.
So, but the thing is, so when you're doing those partials at the end, you've got an opportunity there to create which you could, for the reasons I just explained, is what is a superior stimulus with less energy demand. So that's why you can do that. If you have that grinder up where there's no more concentrics left at all,
yeah,
you can do a controlled eccentric in most cases,
right?
Unless sometimes you feel like, oh, my nervous system just like
you get shot,
dropped out. Yeah, you're just dropped out. Like that's probably a psychological, and there's some inhibition on those eccentrics too that comes into play. But and by that time, like if you're trying with like squats or you know something where you have to have really good torso control, like you have to have, like if your form goes out of whack, then you're screwed. You want to be careful, like trying to do, like, imagine going to squats to like this. It's like you just have one of those grinder reps where it's everything in your power to keep your back in a good position, you know, and your back almost folds over but not quite, and then you're going to try to do an eccentric.
Yeah, that would
be tough. Then you've got a limitation in your low back and your form that could possibly create an injury, so you got to be careful.
Yeah,
but yeah, so those partials are, that's something I haven't seen that studied at all. I mean, directly in that, you know, in the context we're talking about here, but there's something to say for those. But you got to be somewhat judicious in to what extent you apply those, because they do wreck the nervous system probably a little bit more.
Sure.
Because it's a maximal effort there, and they will create a more muscle damage than just an extra rep effort would have too, because it's an eccentric kind of contraction. So,
all right, listen, I want to go to this next question here, because it ties right in, really. You know, we talked a lot here about concentrics, a little bit about eccentric. Now, how about this? Doc, what do you think of isometric training? And Charles Atlas said he didn't touch weights. He thought that maybe in the quarantine, this could be of benefit.
If you get sand kick in your face, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are studies, there are numerous studies showing muscle growth can be had from isometric actions. In fact, I've got a couple of those cited in my fortitude training book. There was one that was literally, I think there were 60-second isometric efforts that produced muscle growth, and that's just about, that's the bottom end of the range of what Dante had in his extreme stretches, his max efforts, and what I prescribe in the extreme stretches of fortitude training and the occlusion stretches of fortitude training.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can definitely produce muscle growth that way. The thing is, like with everything here, there is the law of diminishing returns. So if you're like, you know, if you're a pro bodybuilder and you just are used to like just you've been just training your ass off and you've got, you know, you've been just fighting tooth and nail for every ounce of muscle that you could possibly have, you're going to have to fight tooth and nail using an isometric contractions in a way that will probably seem a little bit weird. Because, I mean, imagine you can do like a pec exercise.
Yeah.
And there are various like literally it's like. Like all effort, all out, everything you can possibly do, like this, you know.
Right.
You got to learn how to breathe. You don't want to pass out from a Valsalva. So it's a totally different way of doing things, but it can be had, and it can be done.
Huh.
And in newbies, it is a stimulus for muscle growth, without a doubt.
Okay.
The studies that I've seen, they seem to favor more muscle growth, and actually, you can kind of change the optimal length of muscles by changing the angles of the fibers in those muscles that are pinnated when the exercise is done in a lengthened position. So like if you just did like for bicep curl, like, or isometric curl like this,
yeah,
versus doing it in a lengthened position, you tend to get more muscle growth in the lengthened position.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And you tend to get that same kind of effect on changing optimal length of the muscle and the pronation angle from doing eccentrics as well. It kind of makes sense because the signal that you're sending to the muscle is that it's going to have is that the forces that it's encountering are so powerful that they are literally forcing the muscle into an eccentric contraction. You think of sort of more a naturalistic type of scenario where someone is the body is being exposed to like these forces that are. They're so powerful that they keep on literally overwhelming the nervous system and the muscular system and just forcing eccentrics, a ton of force. You want to then make sure that muscle doesn't get lengthened so far past its optimal length that you don't have any actin and myosin or very good actin and myosin interaction. So you want to make sure it's strong in that lengthened position because it's being forced into that lengthened position again and again and again. It's a teleological argument, like it sort of makes sense when you think about it after the fact, but it does that the muscle would then say, okay, well, I'm going to be exposed to tremendous forces that are going to either be in the lengthened position when doing isometrics. And you presume that the presumption would be that you're not just doing what we do. It's an unnatural act to try to produce forces to make the muscle grow, is that there's something in the environment that is, forcing me, I'm having to produce maximal effort forces in this lengthened position. It makes sense that the muscle would adapt its architecture to match lengthened position. Or if the muscle is being forced to do eccentric contractions, it makes sense that the muscle would then change its optimal length so that it could have good force production at the end of the range of motion.
Yeah.
When those eccentric contract, because that's like literally that's what it's being exposed to.
Yeah.
It's pretty badass. So.
Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com and use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. I always think of when I remember Dorian Yates one time was talking about failure, and he said, you know, first you're going to fail on the concentric. And he said, but after that, there's still other types of failure that exist. You know, he said, isometric is next. If you can't do a concentric, you can still do an isometric. He said, and if you can't do an isometric, you can still do an eccentric. There's that tier. I've always reminded myself of that too. And I feel like if you really want to harness intensity in a set, it's important to know that, because a lot of times you start to fail and you think like, oh, I'm done. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you just let the weight down. A lot of people, I think, cheat themselves out of that last negative, you know, portion of the rep, you know, you're not completely done yet. And those thoughts, I can't remember where I heard him say that. It was probably in a video, but it was like probably a half decade ago, at least maybe longer, that I heard him say that. And it meant a lot to me in understanding, you know, what my body's doing when I'm lifting weights.
Yeah, that fits with the passage that I just read from the article that Stu Phillips was an author on, is that effort. Effort is what typifies, it's the essence of what makes the resistance exercise stimulus so potent for producing muscle growth. And that fits with the force velocity curve. You can produce more force on an isometric than at any concentric contraction. And you can only produce high forces during slow concentric contractions. And if the muscle is fatigued, in order to get enough force out of that fatigued muscle to keep a weight moving, it can only do it at a slow speed.
Yeah.
Until eventually you come to a stop, which is an isometric contraction. That would be isometric failure. So you'd have concentric failure, you can no longer shorten, and then you'd have isometric failure. And then if you don't have anyone to help you, eventually if you just tried to hold that weight, eventually you would start to have an eccentric contraction.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, you can add the number of forced reps. I mean, we used to do all this shit. When I was a kid, we used to just like forced reps for like every set.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like literally, like it was just, you know, you're like deadlifting every time you had the incline, someone was incline pressing, you're going to be ready for some deadlifts. And the stiff leg is for the partner, you know?
Right, right.
So all of that, those are all intensification techniques.
Yeah.
And you have to contextualize those. And it's funny, like Yates said that, and he's considered sort of a lower volume approach. His warm-up sets sort of contributed to some degree, but his approach was definitely not like, you know, train insane with 50 sets per muscle group.
Right, right.
And Dante knew this when he constructed fortitude training, because when you do rest-pause sets, ideally you do those with a partner and you start each of those segments of the rest-pause set on the negative.
Okay.
And you finish on the negative too. So you would, like, let's say you're on a hammer strength press of some sort. Your partner would bring the weight out so you can start on a negative. So you get a negative before you get a concentric every single set. So let's say you go and like you fail and you get to where you can no longer lift. You don't just let the weight go. You lower it under control and get that negative. Take your break. Your partner would bring you back up to the starting point, and you start on a negative. When you do that, you can add it up. Let's say you're getting a negative at the start that you wouldn't otherwise, and you're getting like a half of a negative rep when you fail that you wouldn't have gotten if you just let the weight go.
Right.
You do that three times. Add that together, you're getting four or five negative reps that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Sure.
With the load that you're using, plus the pulses or the partials at the end of a and Dante's like, you can, you know, he thought that was the least important part of a rest pause set, but I always thought that was a pretty important part. Dante used to say, and hopefully I'm not misspeaking for him now, maybe he's changed his mind, but I remember him saying that, you know, he's like, you're getting used to handling the weight, which is very true.
Okay.
So you do a rest pause set. For people who don't know, this is DC training, dog crap training. You'd pick a weight where your total number of reps, the standard one might be like 12 to 15. So you might get nine, you do nine reps. So you start with a negative, you do nine reps, maybe you fail in your ninth one, and then you do a negative under control, get out, take 12 to 15 breaths. Your partner lifts it back up, you get like another two or three or four, and then you do that again until you fail again. And then you do partials. So your partner would bring that back up for you with no concentric. Yeah. Ideally, so because you don't use the energy. If you had like, after all that, if you just that concentric, that might be like the only that might be your one rep. Mm-hmm. That might be your one rep max. So when you try to do a partial, you're gonna fatigue much more quickly. A lot of that's probably the nervous system. But if someone lifted up, the idea would be to shoot for like 30 seconds on those negatives. Rarely, like, that would almost never happen. But you could get 15 or 20 seconds out of that. And that's all those eccentric partials if you really push and really fight. And I remember doing this with Dave, and like, that's when, as a good partner, you know, I'd be in Dave's face saying, hold that motherfucker, hold that, don't let it beat you, don't let it beat you, don't let it beat you, go, 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 bring that shit back up, bring it back up, bring it back up. And like, that is like a 20-second period of pretty much pure max effort that you could do, because a lot of it's just eccentrics coming down. So that was a key, but that's why you're not, for most muscle groups, you're doing one rest pause set.
Yeah.
You know, every 5 days. That's it. Because you've got those extra negatives and you've got that pulse. Those pulses are partials in there.
It's so brutal.
And that's totally brutal. So, and that's everything you got. Plus you got the logbook prompting you. Like, that is pure refined stimulus for growth.
Yeah.
Taking advantage of eccentrics being advantageous, tons of metabolic stress on those pulses, and then making sure you recover and eat your ass off. I mean, he put a lot of pieces together in that program that are just beautiful.
Yeah.
But that focus on the eccentrics, like, you know, I think Dorian would do that too. Like, he'd have a, you know, a part, like, I remember him doing those like on side laterals.
Oh yeah, that's right.
But yeah, that's like, there's some good, like, that was where he sort of employed that. And he would, I think, throw some body English in there and then just like basically do kind of the pulses, like at the end of a DC set. You can keep that weight moving, in part because when the dumbbells are down near your side, it's much easier than when they're up high.
Right.
So you can keep that going, like, you can prolong that set quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's all you got. And you've used all the motor units going to be able to tackle, and you've really just whacked yourself. So that's why those, if you train that way, you just can't get away with much more than that.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to train that way.
Yeah. Well, I hope that maybe people, after hearing this, will be able to better, because the key is being able to visualize what's happening in your body for me. A lot of times, if I can understand that, then I can get more out of what I'm doing. And hopefully this puts a few more of those pieces together that people who are watching this can go to the gym, go to their home gym or wherever they're training for their next workout, and maybe think about this stuff, because I think that it could change your next workout. It could change that fast.
Yeah. I mean, there are things, if you're going to, like, the question was about like using bands, or sort of wearing the band in the home training idea. You can do a lot. Someone asked me this question on one of my videos too. I'm trying to think how he, sometimes I get mixed up. I can't remember where the source was for this. I think it was on Instagram, but he asked about like prolonging a set and going from like doing incline push-ups, which you can't get as many on, most people can at least, to when he fails, and then dropping down to doing regular push-ups, and then doing push-ups on some kind of a decline. And if you're thinking about like the upper pecs, those will still get activated to some degree, even on the decline.
Sure.
So you can do that. That's something, you're just creating a mechanical drop set. And you can do that with flies, like that, if people have found that fly, banded fly, that fly band exercise I did, you can start off with doing presses, and then when you fail on presses, you start off doing flies, and when you fail on flies, you do presses.
Okay.
Or if you want to make it even more fun, you do press flies.
Press flies.
Press flies, which I have people do, like you have a weak chest, sometimes a total, you press up, and then you fly down.
I have never done those in my life, I don't think.
Oh, no? Yeah, those are badass.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I've ever done those. I'll try those on my next chest workout.
You're going to get sore as shit, because you're so much, you're basically, you're doing a forced rep on the fly on the way up, because you're using your It's a mechanical drop set, or mechanical. You're using your triceps.
Yeah.
And then you can fly down more than you can fly up. So
no shit.
You use the assistance there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are not. Huh. You can do the same thing with an overhead thruster. You can do overhead press flies.
Oh,
like that. Yep.
Yeah. Huh.
So,
I'd have to watch my shoulder on the overhead, but I could definitely do that. I think with just the press fly. That sounds like for a chest. That's a good one. That'd be good.
Oh, yeah. They're demonic, man.
Yeah.
They'll get you really sore.
Yeah, because the amount that I could fly, I mean, I'm not one of those. Like I've seen some guys that. We have some guys around here. There's this kid. He's not a kid anymore. Jordan Janowitz. Anybody who's watching that's a Michigan guy. You know who Jordan is.
Yeah.
I've seen Jordan just grab like the 90s, you know, and he's just flying away with those things. So
yeah.
I'm not that guy, but I could imagine, you know, even with like a 40-pound dumbbell, I can press that up easily. But then going into a fly with that after, that's a really nice negative.
What do you typically do flies with?
Flies, I'd probably use maybe, I don't really do a lot of flies, honestly, but because I usually use pec deck now, and usually I do pec deck first, and then I into my chest pressed second. Mm-hmm. If I were to pick up some dumbbells, I could probably comfortably do sets, probably 50s, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be on the heavier side. You know, I could probably get a good squeeze out of it with a nice stretch with even like 30s, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't done flies for a while, be careful doing these. But
for sure.
You can actually use more weight on a press fly than you would on a fly.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Because you're just saying you can handle more on that negative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that makes total sense. And obviously, I wouldn't just go up high quickly. I'd feel it out and climb. But yeah.
Yeah. And like you got to be careful at the transition. You know, go down because you got a lot. Now you're in this sort of this potentially injurious position because you got a lot of weight there. So you got to be really careful with bringing it in close.
Yeah.
So don't go all the way out to deep and then kind of get fucked and stuck, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to find your arc will be a little bit different for anyone who's watching this. So,
uh-huh.
But, and then bring it down and press up. So like, just be careful on the transition from the fly into the press.
That's fun.
And you can do those with bands, you know,
that's the thing.
Like that's the thing with bands is that they get there's a different dimension to the balancing that you have to do with the bands.
Absolutely.
You know, it's one of the reasons why bands are different than chains. Bands create a more equal force.
Sure.
Especially when you're like lowering, if you have bands on a bar versus chains on a bar, when you lower the bar, you've got, the fact that the chains are now free falling.
Yeah.
So there's a free falling effect. If you go really fast, the chains will basically be unloaded. Whereas the band will catch up with the bar pretty readily and still maintains force.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of people tend to get more sore using bands than chains because you have more loading on the eccentric, especially if you're someone who tends to do faster eccentrics than the average person.
But on the other hand, chains look a lot cooler. So there is that.
They do. They do. That's true. Yeah. That's absolutely true. So, but with the bands, sometimes it's just kind of weird and awkward trying to like get a really heavy band like with the presses, but you have more control because you're stronger to press it up, and then you can do that fly with the band. So you can find a good way to set up the bands.
That's a great idea.
That way. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
So the thing too is like you can also like with that movement, for instance, it's all this like just winging it basically, but you can also set yourself up so that you shift the mechanical loading to some degree by moving your body even.
Okay.
So, you know, you might be able to step back a little bit. If you're like, let's say you got a band behind you doing a press with it. You might be able to like just get into like a bit of a groove, a power groove is what Dante used to call it, sort of, and, you know, allow yourself to step back a little bit so you can get the bands here. Maybe you've got a bar connected to the bands. I've seen some people doing that now. And then you can step into it for the eccentric and create a little more force.
I can see
that. Yeah. So you can employ that same principle of being weaker on the concentric, stronger on the eccentric to how you do the bands. Because a lot of those, you're not on a bench.
Yeah.
You're standing up, you're kneeling or whatever. So you can move your body in space to some degree to accommodate your strength during the shortening versus the lengthening portions of the rep.
Mm.
to some degree. It doesn't always work out that way, but you can keep that in mind. It's like, how can I make this load the eccentric?
Yeah.
Which is what band, and you know, in a way, people say, well, can you grow from bands? In a way, bands could be superior to free weights if we just think of that chains versus band comparison. Free weights tend to deload the faster you do an eccentric. There's some, when you transition, you come back down, there's a free fall effect there that lessens the load. That doesn't happen with bands.
Yeah.
The only thing with bands, though, is that depending on the band and how much stretch you put into them, when the band doesn't have the same force depending on how long it is. So, like, if some bands, like, in order to get the right amount of force, you got to really stretch the band out. But then if your range of motion basically is longer than the length of the band where the band has good tension, then you get a weird loading curve.
Yeah.
And that's messed up. And that's why I posted me using the bungee cords.
Yeah.
Because you can tie bungee cords together to do that, create that effect, or get different bands, of course, as well.
Well, we managed to answer like a couple questions, good, solid two questions or so, questions in the hour. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you wanted to make sure we nailed though before we took off here?
There was one other one that I was going to message the person who asked it. Let me see if I can find it here. Oh, I think we got that one. Okay, he asked that. We answered the one about Charles Atlas.
Yes. Yeah, that was an isometric question.
Oh, someone asked, could you potentially add in loading days for biceps and triceps every – I think he's talking about fortitude training.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't do that. Arms, if you end up loading the arms with heavy stuff, you really tends to give most people tendonitis. Mm. And then if your biceps or triceps have got tendonitis, then you're fucked for chest, shoulder, and back training.
Oh, yeah.
So people ask that question all the time because they want bigger arms. I've got a whole how-to on using fortitude training for bringing up weak muscle groups like the arms, folks.
There's I don't know if you'll have an answer for this one. Somebody who asked on the feed says, strange question, any harmful effects when CLEN and THC interact in the system? Just seems counterproductive. Any other sides that could cause harm? I'm not sure if you would know that one offhand, Scott, but figure I'll throw it at you since Riley asked.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously different receptors. In that scenario, what I'm seeing is that someone is using CLEN for fat loss and they can't go to sleep, so they're probably using the THC to help themselves sleep.
Possibly.
So, that'd be my guess. And that's like, you just take that as a generic situation.
Yeah.
Someone's using downers to counteract the uppers and then the uppers to counteract the downers, so to speak. Yeah. You know this, you know, from this is not a good scenario to be in, generally speaking.
Sure.
Because then you're basically covering the negative effects of each drug with the other drug.
What's wrong with that?
The more drugs, the better.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I wouldn't. Maybe. Figure out another way to deal with that.
All right.
So, but direct, you know, the beta receptors. I mean, and the cannabinoid receptors are different systems. But of course, they're all. I mean, we're talking about neurons here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a wonky situation to be at. I'd say bail ship on that one. Hit the eject button.
All right. Well, guys, I hope you pick something up here. I hope that I hope you can apply this. I feel like I'm going to be able to apply this stuff to my next workout. I hope everybody else can too. For another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. Of course, check out our sponsor, TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES. Follow Fortitude Training over at Instagram. Follow Advices Radio Network while you're at it. And, of course, go to BYOBBCoach.com. You can pick up Dr. Scott's book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, there. Also, go to Amazon. And we've got a link in the description. You can get the hardcover there. For another episode of Muscle Minds, as I said, Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally, guys. We'll see you next time.
Thanks
for your participation.
Peace.